China to do well in Europe. Now, the big prize of the war was China, not Europe. And in China, there was raging a civil war between the Mao Stalinist forces and Chiang Kai-shek. In preparation for intervening in that war, they were proposing to shift the soldiers from Europe to East. But they developed a big movement against this called the Green Fruits Home Movement, and they prevented it. So that not only were the troops, but the family, the friends, and the comrades of the troops in the States were raising so much hell that they didn't dare carry through their project, and they had to bring the troops back home. Shortly after that, there followed the Churchill, after the war, there followed the Churchill speech in Missouri in 1946, which sparked the Cold War, together with the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan. The Cold War then became the modus vivendi for the operation of American capitalism, both at home and abroad. That required another shift, you see, because in the Cold War, results of the Cold War is many of the officials who have been built up as big heroes by the Stalinists split with Stalinists, including Joe Kern and Mike Quill and a whole raft of them. We've been built up as the great working class heroes of the century. But over the support of the reaction against the Communist Party. A split in their trade union movement, and then they were in real trouble. One of the results of the Cold War in 1946 was the serial left turn of the Communist International, that is international communism. Communist International had been dissolved in 1943, but of international Stalinism, to a pseudo radical position. They established the Common Front, the Communist Information Bureau. They established a newspaper in Belgrade, the Yugoslavia. Here in this country, in 1948, they ran Wallace on a progressive party ticket, that is, ostensibly independent action, what they called independent action, but there was nothing independent about it because Wallace went in on a strict capitalist program. In fact, he was so far to the right of Truman in the election. Truman, who I told you yesterday, who came out not only for the repeal of Taft-Hartley, but for every liberal, every advance, even every radical slogan that he could think of. He was promising everything to everybody. But he made Wallace look like a reactionary. And he said that they were estimating conservatively that Wallace was going to reach 5 million votes. And then he said, so sure were they all that Truman would be defeated that the Chicago Tribune came out with a special edition the night before the votes were counted, duly elected, and distributed all over the city, So convinced were they that this von Truman would not be elected, and he could change him. He was elected. He left as the president of these here United States of America. 1948 also marked a very historical period, or year rather, for the Socialist Workers' Party. It was the first year in which the SWP ran a presidential election campaign. The first year we ran Bush, Dobbs and Carlson, Dobbs and Grace Carlson. Now the Cold War and the pseudo-left turn of the Communist Party arouse the wrath of the Roman bureaucrats. They're breaking ranks. Now here during the war, they were 110% for those amendments, or Truman supported them all. Supported. They were the only tendency in the whole country. And this country proved the bureaucracy of the U.S. government supported most of National Service Act, most of submitting an act to Congress calling for the right to draft workers to be sent to any industry in the country. The Communist Party was the only organization in the whole country to support that National Service Act. They have no deal with those who are facing the people lost. Didn't have the support of the later papers. Except the Stalin, that is not enough for Roosevelt to adopt his National Service. But they launched a witch hunt in the CIO, in which all the erstwhile seeking stalwarts, Kern, Phil et al., caved in and joined the witch hunt. And this led to the expulsion of the CPRS-led unions from the CIO in 1949 under the following amendment to their constitution. And I quote, a 1949 amendment to the CIO constitution, which empowered the executive board by a two-thirds vote to expel any union, the policies and activities of which are inconsistently directed for the achievement of the program or the purposes of the Communist Party and fascist organization or other totalitarian movement rather than the objectives and policies set forth in the Constitution of the CIO. And on the left of it, they kicked them out. They kicked out all the Stalinist led unions who did not conform or comply or support this amendment. Now that required another shift in our policy in the trade union movement. After the ouster of Browder, and when the Communist Party split after Foster took over and instituted no change from Bob Browder, we entered a bloc with the dissidents. That is, those members of the Communist Party who broke with the party because they had anticipated that the ouster of Browder, who dissolved the Communist Party, who led the dissolution of the Communist Party into the Communist Political Association during the war, and the elevation of Browder to number one guru, they thought that was going to change the character of the party and make it again a militant class struggle party, which it did not. And so a whole layer of some of the top leaders, some of the founders of the Communist Party was Bill Gunn, the brother of Ray Gunn, Harrison George, three or four others who were founders of the American Communist Party, split and set up a number of little groups. One of these groups took over control of the headquarters of the National Maritime Union in New York, and we entered into a bloc with this group against Kern. We had previously supported Kern against them during the Kern-Mostert fight. So, you see, we had to shift back and forth. We had to weigh at each stage in our development what the issues were, what the relationship of force there, how best we could utilize our small forces in order to affect the development of the movement in the direction in which we would have liked it to go. Now that was the beginning of the end of the Communist Party and the trade union movement. Together with the Spritz, they organized then jurisdictional raids against the remaining unions controlled by the CP, or led by the CP. In self-defense, they executed a number of fugitives
submarines, but they still control other unions, and with one or two exceptions, the United Electrical Rugby, one or two exceptions, and even they broke with the CP, they were finished in the union. They had dissipated their entire mass union movement, and were in the position of having little or no influence in the American trade union movement, which is their situation today.
Forbids strikes by the teachers, and it does not. it penalizes the teachers who go on strike, who violate this prohibition by specific penalties, which withdraw from the unions the clause which permits them to use the what do you call it?
Check-off.
Check-off, yes. It takes a check-off away and imposes financial penalties double the time of the period in which they were on strike. And they accepted this as an exchange for the right to be recognized as collective bargaining agents. And that has been the pattern for government rights. Now, we're getting a lot better, so you see, you know, this whole body first. Because some people, brother, you know, ran out of money. I don't know why. They began to demand many of the things that they granted, they began to demand they take them back. And not only that, but in addition to that, they lowered the boom on them for rather substantial loans to keep the city functioning. And all of this, was granted without a struggle, not only by the teachers, but by the other municipal unions. With the promise that at the next turn of the screw, when New York recovers its financial fortunes and becomes viable again, when the money somehow or other starts flowing in, when things return to normal, in quotation marks, all of these footings will be coming back to them. By whom? By the strings of labor. Being the bond? Yeah. Is he still there, or some reasonable facsimile? Being. Now this is what they're building on. Building on quicksand. And the map. But this has been a pattern of the cities, major cities throughout the country. In San Francisco, during the strike of the building crafts, the same thing, but the council who were elected by the votes of labor, who were elected by, or to be supported by labor, were the ones who turned and rejected their demands and submitted propositions, all of which are couched in terms of saving the taxpayers' money, and all of the taxpayers are saving money. And usually vote for these propositions, which more and more curb the union and take away things that they have done before. Atlanta, Los Angeles, Seattle, these are some of the results of this policy. Now they're going to have to change this policy. The workers of the union are moving to become more and more restless, dissatisfied, discontented. They can't understand this business of meekly surrendering things that they have fought for, what they have told, what part of their due as municipal workers. And so opposition are forming. Opposition to a more progressive character than what I've seen in many years in the trade union, in the teachers, in the municipal workers, among the municipal workers, and in the government employees and the whole. The whole policy is becoming so ludicrous. It's becoming so ridiculous that it becomes a subject of caricature. I have a clipping from a long time of time written, a column written by Jerome Grossman, who's a Boston radio commentator, a member of the Democratic National Committee, and the new Democratic Coalition National Executive Committee, a Democrat. And it's entitled Labor's Liberal Forum from Congress. He wanted to say that in the 1976 presidential election, organized labor spent $11 million on behalf of Jimmy Carter. $11 million An anonymous figure, he says, when considered in relation to $20 million, is the card campaign received from the federal government. That is, half between half of them. Carter, he says, would not have been elected without organized labor. And then what happened? When the question of the minimum wage came up, he said the government proposal for a total increase in minimum wage from $2.30 to $2.50 ignored labor's pressure for $3 per hour. Not so incidentally, a person earning $2.50 per hour lives well below the poverty line. He goes on to say, he says, Jimmy Carter is a political genius. Less than 2 weeks later, after he had been elected, he found a way to give the AML a rousing public relations victory by giving him to the AML CIO and refusing to allow three Soviet trade unionists to attend the international longshoremen's and warehousemen's convention in the U.S. He capitulated. Gave in to the government. And then, he says, despite President Carter's human rights pledge to liberalize entry into the United States, and despite the fact that the longshoremen's union asked specific permission for the Russians to attend. One of the questions he raised is, what would he have done if the American Dentist Association had requested permission for three Soviet dentists to enter the United States and attend their convention? What would Carter and his human rights have been doing? Well, this is a big victory. He says, of course, the AFL-CIO is militantly anti-communist, but it is difficult to understand what is being here. There is no communist movement of any consequence in the United States organized labor. As a State Department official remarked, they refused to cover all of the American Dental Association wanted to be used to see Soviet dentists. Barring the Russians didn't include a lot of the similar American workers. Then you would think that much. If you didn't add a penny to a single envelope, if you raise a million wages or create a single job, it merely gave the entire administration an opportunity to award a victory of no consequence to the AFL-CIO at no cost to Carter or his business. With such political tactics, it seems clear that the AFL-CIO has so little political clout where it really counts in influencing government decisions to raise the living standards. The fight back movement, to me, has a unique character. I can't remember even going back as far as the 30s of any movement of this kind. I would have to go back to 1922. And I could find anything comforting to the implications of the fight-back movement, and that is the organization of the Trade Union Education League in 1922, I believe. The Trade Union Education League was organized by the Communist Party, and was organized as a propaganda group. And its main points were amalgamation, or industrial form of all arguments. Nothing in terms of time. And recognition of the Soviet Union and the later part. Those were the three points of the Trade Union Education League. They proposed to attain these through a process of education. They sent out a newspaper called Labor Herald, had lectures going throughout the country, organized groups in the union to fight for this program. And with all the forces guarded the unions. Fight back movement assume the same charge. And that is why it elicited such a response, such a reaction from the official trade union in Europe. Where Beanie came out and blasted it. Shanker came out and blasted it. You think that their positions were directly threatened. They're not threatened. Not threatened. The rest of the time. Well, let me quote from the Fight Back program, not the entire program, it's very long, but some of what I consider some of the key points. When the troops are voted on our contract, now that sounds like a simple democratic meaning. But actually, in this period, it assumes the character of a transition meeting. Because more and more, this right of voting on the union contract is not committed in the trade union. Except in the only period that the union was there on the waterfront, where the union was presented, and unless it was satisfied immediately, they would agree to just sit down and walk off the ship. And that only lasted for a very long period of time. No man can ask him until the union is present. That means any worker is victimized, remains on the job until the company comes to stay. That is not the present system. Present system is that the worker is fired, then agreement is filed, and then he goes through the whole agreement procedure, and finally ends up in arbitration, and if you win in arbitration, the worker is restored to his job, the original act. And most of the time, without compensation. So that doesn't mean negotiating agreement by all members in basic steel. Now the experimental negotiation agreement, as they call it, very simply means compulsory arbitration. If you go into negotiations with the employer and in advance you announce you're not going to strike, the union is in not a very good position to be in, and he's significant to be in. If the employer knows you're not going to strike from the very beginning, then it is not conducive to liberalizing the attitude of the employer towards granting better wages, lower hours, and better working conditions. At the worst, the whole question is going to go to arbitration. And in arbitration, the employer can depend upon his point of view getting adequate recognition. Now the question of union democracy, the question of union democracy in this period becomes a transition throughout it. You cannot fight for anything. You cannot achieve anything in the union unless you have the democratic right to present your point of view. And it's not only true of today. If you read, and let me quote, Trotsky, I'm going to quote on the two central issues that he considered paramount important in the transitional movement, in the transitional movement. And the primary slogan for this struggle is the complete and unconditional independence of the trade unions in relation to the state of the primary slogan. This is a struggle to turn trade unions into the ordinary of the broad exploited masses and not the ordinary of the labor aristocracy. That is the second slogan is pro-German democracy. This second slogan flows directly from the first and presupposes for its realization the complete freedom of trade unions in the interior of the colonial state. Now we have a lot of slogans as an after trade union democracy that abstract characters that are meaningless. The thing that makes this so meaningful is its concrete character. It's not a slogan demanding union democracy in the abstract, and everybody is in favor of union democracy in the abstract, even England. But immediately tied and directly to this experimental negotiating agreement is tied to this with market union and steel workers union of taking away from the ranks the right to vote on the agreement. In 1958, 30% of all union contracts, of all official union contracts were rejected when submitted to ratification by the ranks. And more, the ranks have been discontented and dissatisfied and have rejected these contracts negotiated by the union official government. And so it's necessary to find some device to prevent the ranks from exercising this right of ratification. And that's the experimental negotiating agreement. That's compulsory, obviously. That's why we attach so much importance to this movement, not to Sadowski, but to this movement, because it's directed not only to against Abel, and McBride is directed to the entire trade union movement. More and more, the steel workers' bureaucracy sets the pattern and the model for the other unions. There is no accident that Sadowski, for example, supported in the mine workers' election, he supported the candidate of, who's the one that's in the assignment now for killing, for assassinating supported Boyle's candidate, contributed funds to elect Boyle's candidate in the miners' union. That says something about Abel and McBride and what they're after. Now, will Sadowski carry through the struggle in all the implications? I don't know. I don't care. That's not decisive. I wouldn't say I don't care. I would like to see him do it, but there would be a defendant. But that's not decisive. If he falters, someone else will do the job for the movement, which is the important thing. The movement that raised Sadowski to the rank of top leader will produce others who will carry on to the very end. For it is the movement that is important, and the conditions that gave rise to a Sadowski will not go away. They will deepen and grow more exacerbated with time. It is upon the granite rock of objective material fact that we base our optimistic view that the movement to transform the human into revolutionary instruments of workers' power will conquer. It will conquer.
Support that thing is wanted on the side of support.
It was being created in Scotland, see? And he not only had a program, but in the abstract, if you use it in the abstract, it is synthesizing it around what we see as a central issue in the trade union movement today. The real fight of the ranks, you know, the fight of the ranks for the right of the ranks to run as far as they can fight on their own trade union in Africa, which becomes more and more difficult and impossible. With the existence of capitalism in its purely decay, the capitalist state cannot tolerate that. You see, that's what makes it a transitional, almost spiritual character than a transitional event. In the spirit state of capitalism, capitalism cannot tolerate a democratic trade union. Struggle against the state and part of the state is going to require them now. For example, we don't criticize Sadowski view for not advancing what we consider to be our central political slogan, that is, demand for a new democratic party. So, although we have not recruited one iota from the conviction that unless the working class takes the political role, it cannot even take step number one in the struggle against the violence. Every step that the fact that the working class takes out of class is a political struggle. And then there are other possibilities now, that includes the struggle in the country. Non-monarchical to this policy of subordination to the Democratic Republican Party. But despite that, because of the importance of the match, to me, women, that is, in the state and in the democracy, he said, all right, we need the total right to continue the agitation. Promoted the idea of the necessity of independent working class labor action. Yet, we need political support to the Sadowski slogan, or to this movement. And our, as I say, our, in this sense, our tactics is more to emphasize support. The others, it is more to emphasize criticism. Now, this happens in politics too. For example, we've given candidates of the Communist Party critical support. And other working class organizations. Where do we consider that they are working class organizations? But their only emphasis is or should be on the criticism, not in